We'll call the meeting to order. This is a State Government Finance Committee meeting for Wednesday, March 9th, 2011. And the bill we have before us today is House File 192, Representative Downey. Representative Downey, would you move to the table and begin the presentation of your bill? We need one more person here before we have a quorum, so you can go ahead and start the presentation, and as soon as we have our quorum, we will then officially open the meeting and have you officially move the bill. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill is an attempt to equip our state workforce for the challenges of the future. We've been discussing here in this committee and many others, obviously, the challenges we have before us, and clearly, squarely on the executive branch agencies, the challenge of trying to reform what we do, redesign what we do, do things better, faster, cheaper, and serve people better. And this bill is an attempt to provide a set of tools for the public sector workforce to adapt and grow and be part of that solution. The legislature, the executive branch, the state workers all have to work together if we're going to accomplish this very tough challenge in front of us. And my own sense, having done quite a bit of work in the public sector and the private sector together, is that the challenges are really no different. Private sector versus public sector, and frankly, the ability of our state workforce to accomplish the same kinds of productivity gains and be engaged in the process, much like private sector workers are, is also no different. But we do have a set of structures, I think, that really hinder our public sector workforce's ability to help us get the job done. So this bill attempts to put some new things in place that will empower our public sector workers. The kind of parameters of the bill restrict these rules to the executive branch agencies, thinking that we would do this first in the executive branch, not attempt to spread it more broadly to the judiciary or the legislative, but start with an area that we know that we actually have some impact with here on this committee. And really to change the status quo and try and bring out the power and capacity and capability of our public sector workers in the executive branch agencies to get after this redesign, reform, and have them be the catalyst and part of doing that with us together. And I'm fully convinced that our state workforce is up for the challenge, and if we give them these kinds of tools, I think we'll empower them in new ways to be part of it. So specifically to
Representative Downey, we now have a quorum, so we will officially call the meeting to order, and would you move your bill then?
I would move my bill, House File 192, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus state government finance bill.
Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the four main components of the bill, I'll give a brief description of them, and then we can have discussion and testimony, and I'm sure we'll cover the details of those four provisions. But the first is that we would equalize pay and benefits in the public sector with the private sector. And I know there's been, and we've talked about this in other committee hearings and other discussion forums, there has been plenty of demagoguery out there through the election and into this legislative session about who's willing to pay their fair share and who's the source of the problem. And members, this provision is intended to part the clouds and make sure that the taxpayers have every confidence that we are fairly and appropriately compensating our public sector workers, and so that our public sector workers have every confidence that that is the same as well. So this would actually freeze wages and benefits in the executive branch agencies for 1 year, during which we would conduct a study where we would look position by position where there are comparables in the private sector and make sure that the wage and benefits for those positions in state government are roughly comparable to what you would find out in the market as well. I've included a study in your packets from the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, and you can kind of flip through that as we're talking. There were a number of studies released, maybe in the last year or so, that attempted to compare public versus private sector workforces and their compensation levels The flaw in those studies was that they didn't include positions. They simply talked about educational attainment and years of experience and attempted to compare what people made at different levels of experience and educational attainment in the public sector versus the private sector. And that's an interesting, those kind of methodologies are probably an interesting and important part of economic analysis and broader workforce analysis. But to determine whether or not we are fairly compensating public sector workers, they kind of break down because they don't do anything with regard to the position or the work that the person is performing. And so this study, as I've envisioned it, would actually cut through all of that, do a study, and give us some comparables. And you can see through the work of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association study that some of that work has already been done, at least at a high level here. And we would retain a professional firm who does this as part of their business to do it in a more comprehensive way. Some good points were raised in the Government Operations Committee about how do you compare positions such as a correctional, a prison guard, or a police officer. And you can see in the study that there were a number of positions where the comparable to the private sector breaks down because there is no comparable position. And in those cases, I would suggest, and I think any reputable firm would do this anyway, that we would then look at positions in similar positions in different markets just to make sure that we were appropriately compensating people in those positions where there isn't a direct private sector comparison. The second component is contract. I'll call it contract reform, or an ability for public sector workers to compete for outsourced contracts that the state would issue. Right now, as you know, we have, as we've talked about in some other bills, we have the provision of 16C in statute that says that the state can't contract out for certain services if there is a public employee who can do the work. We have run into a number of cases and places where there's probably a better value for the state, better service, better cost, or a combination thereof if we look to the outside world. And in this particular case, I'm suggesting that we look even more comprehensively at the outside world, waive that provision that says we have to do these things in-house. But if we do that as a state, we have to allow the bargaining unit that's performing that work right now to compete for that business unencumbered by the overhead of state government. And there are some fairly famous cases that precipitated this kind of managed competition environment that we're talking about. Maybe most notably, I think the city of San Diego, 10, 12 years ago, looked to outsource its garbage collection. And the collective bargaining unit went out, formed their own little business, and proposed on the work, and guess what? They won that contract. And so I think this is an opportunity for our state workers to participate in that and compete with the private sector and improve the worth and value of what they're doing without all of the overhead of state government attached to it. The third is an employee gain-sharing concept where we would allow the state to structure an incentive program where suggestions that come from our workers are actually rewarded with some kind of a one-time bonus program where you could offer a suggestion, and if it really produced genuine savings or better level of service, the state could reward you for that. And then I've integrated into this bill, House File 192, Representative Stensrud's bill, where we would build a pay-for-performance model in state government where we would have up to 5% of an employee's compensation, the wage side of their compensation, subject to bonus provisions, much like in the private sector. And it's really important when you do that to, I think, have three dimensions to that. One is your own personal performance. How did you do relative to your own personal goals? The second, to make sure that you're not operating as an island and just focused on yourself and what you're doing, is to have your unit or your program goals as part of that bonus structure. And then thirdly, the overall agency and department goals should be a factor of that as well. So just like any other bonus pool in the private sector, we'd have a similarly structured bonus pool, and we direct the administration to construct that program for us and implement it. So members, those are the four main components of the bill, the four tools that I think would really empower our workforce in new ways. And I just want us to take a minute and imagine a reality where our public sector workers are actually rewarded for the good work that they do and the innovation that they bring and the new ideas that they have, and that we create an incentive for them, a financial incentive, an alignment of their compensation with bringing those ideas forward and being part of those big projects that are such a challenge, and being able to reward them for that. And I want us to think about a time where we won't have this conversation about whether we are fairly or unfairly over or under compensating our public sector workers. We just had the Attorney General in here, and it's pretty difficult to attract top talent into the Attorney General's office with the compensation structure we have there. We've heard about plenty of areas in the past, and especially the IT area and the highly technical specialized areas, where we don't compensate well enough to attract the talent that we need. And I think we hear plenty of cases where we're probably overcompensating and paying a premium in certain other positions. So I really think we'd have an opportunity through these four mechanisms to put our state workforce in a position where we don't have those questions anymore, and we really give them the tools and equip them to be part of the solution, and have them driving the solutions to the challenges we face. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for questions and testimony as you see fit.
Questions from the committee. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, when you talk about paper for performance on the 95% of public employees, are you really talking about withholding 5% and then calling that a bonus?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, I welcome Representative Stenzud's comments too after mine. Representative Gauthier, I think the concept is that when you look at any individual's aggregate compensation in any given year, that 5% of that would be part of a bonus pool. If your starting point is today's salary, I don't think I'm contemplating that today's salary would somehow be divided 95-5. I'm just saying that whatever their aggregate compensation is after this study, that 5% of it would be part of an at-risk bonus pool, much like individuals in the private sector. And again, I defer to Representative Stenzud.
So you are talking about a pay cut.
Representative Gauthier.
So you're basically cutting their pay and then saying, if you're a good employee, we'll give you 5% back.
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gauthier, I don't think I'm saying that at all.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative,
you know, I've worked a long time in the private sector, too, and never once did they say 5% of your salary will go into a pool. Never once. And I've gotten plenty of bonuses for my performance, and it was based on my performance and what I provided to the company or the agency. So this is malarkey. But having said that, I'd like to move on. Representative Downing, you make statements like the outside world, outside the complexity of government, and outsourcing. And this is more of a statement than anything. And I think that's rather clever, but quite clearly to me, it is basically saying public employees aren't valued and will engage in corporate welfare. We have sat here for 2 months and heard repeatedly, time after time, we have the leanest workforce, that we have a workforce that is underpaid, that we lose talent repeatedly, and yet we come with bills with pay cuts and contracting out and outsourcing, and it's just an attack on public employees and government. And I think it's about time we call a spade a spade.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gauthier, boy, I couldn't disagree with you more. The fiscal realities that we face, private and public sector, are unavoidable. And thinking that we can just perpetuate the status quo and somehow deal with the challenges that we face, I think pretty clearly by virtue of the budget deficits we've had the last two or three biennia, tell us that we've got to start thinking differently and doing things differently. And I think you could try to improve some of these provisions or argue against the individual provisions, but to characterize the overall effort as somehow being an attack, I think is entirely unfair and inaccurate. And in fact, what we're trying to do is equip state government with a new set of tools to adapt to these realities, and we can pretend that the state workforce isn't going to be reduced by 15% over the next 5 to 10 years. But, I mean, none of us can look at the trend lines of state revenues and the cost of state programs and the economic realities that we face and say it's not going to happen. And everything we've done in this legislative session, every bill that I've offered, has been a way to intentionally and strategically and in a planful way prepare ourselves for that reality. And if we want to continue on the status quo and continue having these budget deficits and continue hitting brick walls, I think the cost and the pain on the public sector workforce is far greater through those mechanisms than actually very intentionally structuring a new reality for those people and intentionally dealing with this long-term fiscal imbalance that we have. So I would fundamentally disagree with your characterization of this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
Oh, I think it's strategic, all right, Mr. Downey. But there is also such a thing as collective bargaining and negotiated contract. And all I've seen in this committee is undermining them time after time after time. And if you think we're going to balance the budget on 15% layoffs of public employees, you're sadly mistaken. I agree we have some work to do in restructuring things, but it's the method of which we do it. And I, for one, value the people that do our work, and we should engage them in the solutions rather than attacking them and saying they're the problem, because clearly that's what your party does.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Downey?
I feel compelled to respond again. You know, Representative Gauthier, I believe in the people and the folks who are doing the work in state government. I am not wed to the structures and the status quo of how we get our work done in state government, and I think that's the difference. And I'll look any public sector worker in the eye and tell them that I 100% believe in their ability to help us get to where we need to go. And if we free them up from some of the constraints that they have and the barriers that they face by virtue of the structure of how we have them working here, we can all get there together. And so to not even infer, but to specifically state that our intention is to somehow go after the public sector workforce, I 100% disagree. Again, if we sit here and pretend that this problem is going to go away and that the status quo is the solution, all evidence is to the contrary. And this is about empowering people and valuing the people, not the structures, not the organization, not the processes that we've locked them into. And what I hear in your argument is that we are only caring for our people if we commit to the status quo of those processes and those structures. And I believe in the people.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that's what I'm saying at all.
Yeah.
I'm saying we've excluded our public workforce in the dialogue and discussion. And there's mechanisms in government to do that. It's called collective bargaining and negotiating. And I'll tell you, I sat on the council and passed two contracts up in Duluth, and there was pay freezes and no upping of benefits because they understood what needed to be done to balance a budget. And what I see here is just an exclusion of that process, and it I find it rather disturbing to me. And I would agree with you that we have things to do. I think it's a process, and it's just a fundamental disagreement on which process we're going to do. And I quite clearly believe that there is no consideration. When we're talking about 15% cuts, do we even engage in the conversation of what are we doing with those people that we have just simply said, you're gone? And that's disturbing to me. We should be a little better than that.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Downey.
Sorry, I feel compelled to respond again. Representative Gauthier, first of all, this bill does not have 15% cuts.
I understand
in it.
That.
Representative Gauthier, please allow him to speak. You've been allowed to speak.
The 15% workforce reduction bill, just to remind you, actually proposed doing it over a 4-year period, relying largely, if not perhaps almost exclusively, on existing turnover, and in those cases where perhaps we can't get there through existing turnover and attrition, an early retirement incentive to get there. So to imply that what we have proposed is some kind of tomorrow cut and 5,000 people are going to be without their jobs. No, it's a very intentional and strategic way to get to an objective and an outcome that we all know is going to come. And so I appreciate you saying that we have a difference of opinion around the process and the mechanisms, because I think in that statement you are entirely accurate. The statements about somehow degrading or not valuing our workforce, I fundamentally disagree with. I think we all value those folks and realize they're the key to the solution. It's just how do we put them in a position to succeed.
We'll just disagree. Representative, and Representative Downey.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would make some clarifications on paper performance, and it's being mutually exclusive to the private sector. I worked for a number of years for the government. In the last 6 years, I had paper performance, and what I can tell you is that it made a significant difference in the organization to have executives tied to paper performance and making sure that people were encouraged to achieve the goals of the organization. I believe that that a paper performance package in most cases will be embraced, and it would be a great way to incent people to do the absolute very best for the organization and for themselves. My pay for performance package was actually much greater than 5%, so there was a lot of incentive to reach the individual goals, the sectional goals, and the organizational goals. So I thank you, Representative Downey, for bringing this issue up.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too want to address the issue that's been brought up about paper performance. As I understand the language of the bill, this is to be done during the biennium ending 2013, so it does not violate any current contract. You could, in fact, if I understand your bill right, Representative Downey, work with the unions, public employee unions, to construct this plan. I could tell you that in the MNSCU system, for faculty, there is a program called University Scholar that provides a 10% one-time bonus to people faculty who have shown themselves to be high-quality scholars and meeting the goals of the university. This was negotiated by our union, the union I'm a member of, along with MNSCU. So these things do exist, and the intention was, and this is here's the question in this, Representative, the intention was that in the construction of this, some money would be set aside for this purpose. It does not necessarily withdraw any money from employment, but in fact builds a pool that could be in addition to current compensation levels. There's nothing about this bill, if I understand it correctly, there's nothing about this bill that says we're taking 5% back from anyone. You can simply put additional money into a pool that provides incentives for better performance. Do I understand that bill correctly, sir?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, I'd direct folks to Article 5 on page 6, starting line 6.5. It actually says the commissioner shall design and maintain a performance appraisal and bonus pay system. And so the bill does not actually define the program. It instructs the commissioner to develop that, and everything in here would be kind of under existing law regarding negotiations, and so I assume it would be fully part and parcel of that existing ongoing process, yes.
So, Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Downey, then this will be subject to negotiation with public employee unions after the commissioner develops the plan. They will have an opportunity to participate in that process to determine what it is that will be in the plan, and it could be a different performance plan for different folks, right? Just thinking of my campus, you've got all different kinds of employees. They're going to have different kinds of performance measures to determine whether or not they're doing their job.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Banyan, yes, that is my intent and my understanding of the bill. And again, I might defer to Representative Stensrud at some point if he wants to chime in. The provisions in the pay-for-performance component are actually part of his pay-for-performance bill. I think that was heard in committee this week as well, so he might have some additional thoughts.
Go ahead. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, I'd like to turn to the fiscal note first, if I could. I have a series of questions. First, I'm just looking down on the first page, total cost savings to the state, and it appears that the 2012-2013 biennium savings total roughly $49 million. And as I look, and then I looked in here a bit, and on page 8, it talks about assumptions of the compensation freeze, which essentially says that this $49 million in compensation freeze savings occur based on an assumption that we would continue the current contracts in place as they stand today. Is that your understanding of where the bulk of the savings will be in the upcoming biennium?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, we just received the fiscal note, and I have not had a chance to validate the assumptions or really go into detail behind the assumptions of the administration in calculating it. So I think what you described is accurate, but I don't want to speak for the department in the details of the assumptions.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, I think we can probably safely assume that the lion's share of the savings that we're seeing in the next biennium come from the wage freeze, not from any of the other provisions of the bill. And when we look forward to 14 and 15, those savings drop to about $500,000. So my guess is that's the result of the compensation freeze not lasting beyond the time when you do the wage study. You think that is fair?
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chairman, I think the absence of numbers in the out biennium is reflective of the fact that we could not predict, or the administration was not willing to predict, the outcomes of the compensation study and where compensation levels would be at. And so I think there's an absence of outcomes from that, and just kind of the perpetuation of the ongoing freeze in the second year. But I think you're accurate.
Well, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, I guess you mentioned this fiscal situation that we're in, that we've got a major budget deficit, and I can understand if you were to propose a wage freeze for state employees to deal with the upcoming biennium. I might not agree with you, but that would be one pretty straightforward way to save money, about $48 million. But for the compensation study and tying future salary and benefits to the private sector, it seems to me has nothing to do with the current budget situation. And what we're really talking about is not about, you know, deficits. What we're really talking about here is changing the relationship between the state of Minnesota and its employees. And that's a separate discussion, but I think we should stay away from this idea that the fiscal situation compels us to fundamentally change the way we compensate state employees, because if that's the case, your bill doesn't really address that. And I wonder if you have a comment to that.
Yeah. Representative Downey?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, I think I agree with everything you said, but I want to paint a little bit broader context. The purpose of this bill, and I think every other bill that we have tried to advance in this area, has been to put us on a sustainable footing to fundamentally and structurally change the cost model of state government for the future, because what we have seen is temporary one-time Band-Aids always running out in the next biennium. And so if we don't fundamentally structurally change the programs, and Representative Gauthier, you're exactly right, this is only one component of our overall challenge, and the program structure needs to change, but the internal operational structure needs to change, and that's the domain of this committee, so that's why we're hearing all of these bills here. So I think that's the big backdrop, is that we have to fundamentally restructure what we're doing. Another dimension of that is that we have a huge wave of retirements coming, and that we have an opportunity, if we don't simply hire behind that wave, to really rethink what we're doing and restructure these operations and put people in new programs and new structures and with new technologies to do the same job or even better at a lower cost and really rethink things. And then the third big backdrop here is we have been engaged in, I think, an extremely harsh rhetorical cycle of first demonizing people that supposedly don't want to pay their fair share, and then demonizing people who are the source of the problem. And I really want to get away from that, and let's just look at these problems objectively and realize that we have no choice but to find a way to get better and more efficient in the activities of state government. And so here's a set of tools that equip employees to get there. The reality is these moves do help us financially in this biennium. It's not the entire solution. Representative Gauthier is right. The bigger part of the solution is somewhere else in programs, and whether we even need to be doing what we're doing or how we reduce those costs. But a piece of it is here. And I would just encourage folks to take a look through the public sector compensation study by the Taxpayers Association. And on page 3, it indicates that 72% of public sector positions have total compensation costs that are 5% greater than their private sector counterparts. 10% of the positions have total compensations that are 5% lower than the private sector. So there's that opportunity to, or that challenge of trying to attract the talent that we need. And then about 18% of them are more or less comparable. And so I think you could look at that and fairly safely argue that, you know what, there's going to be an overall financial benefit in the out years, in the biennia down the road as well. So I think this does get at some of the fiscal issues we face in this biennium and down the road. But the purpose, again, is structural and positioning ourselves for success in the future.
Representative Winkler?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure we're not continuing to mix these issues together. The wage freeze saves us money in the next biennium. The other tools that you're talking about are speculative efforts to change the way we compensate state employees. I guess I'd like to turn to another section. We talked a little bit about this in government operations, but it's on page 2, lines 2.6 to 2.11, where you describe your future compensation study. And the difference between studies of public versus private employees, in addition to all the issues where you can't really obviously find a comparable for a prison guard or for a state patrolman, in addition to those things where government does things differently than what the private sector does, government has to serve everyone instead of just serving the ones who are profitable, there are obviously major differences. But you don't want to account for age or education in the comparison between public and private employment. And now your argument is, well, you shouldn't have a PhD, you know, doing data entry on an accounting system. But it seems to me that there is an advantage to the state to having a well-educated, well-qualified workforce. There's a quality difference. And we also, because we have an older and aging workforce in the state, we have a lot more experience, a lot more expertise. We have a very high-quality labor force at the state level. And I think that brings us some benefit. Now, we could simply look at the skill, effort, responsibilities, and working conditions, but I don't understand why we wouldn't want to account for the fact that this state has invested in training, we've paid people for a long time, we've put money into a pension system. We have really asked people to stay with the state, keep working, get better educated, get better trained, be a better employee. And now we want to take that, turn it around and say, and now as a result of all those things you've done, now you're overpaid and we need to shrink your wages. I think that's breaking a deal. And I don't know why we wouldn't want to accommodate or account for age experience in education.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Winkler, you raise a lot of good questions and good points, and I think everybody's interested in investing in quality on the assumption that we translate that quality of inputs to outcomes. And I don't think we've done a great job in the public sector actually measuring outcomes, and there have been a number of bills, some of which I'm on, some of which others of you are on, that are all trying to drive us to outcomes. And we actually just had a press conference earlier this week about a new innovation in state government where we actually would only pay for outcomes as compared to input measures. And so I think we're going in the same direction there, probably universally. That's not really a partisan issue. That's just let's do things well. And I don't think anybody's arguing in this bill about that somehow we don't need a quality workforce, and in some ways I think it's the exact reverse. It's saying we do have a quality workforce, let's give them the tools and equip them and take away some of the barriers from them doing that. But I, to your specific point about not considering education and years experience, I'll just give you an example from our testimony yesterday from the gentleman from Excipio who did the study on our IT workforce. And one example that he didn't mention but that he did to me when I met with him earlier to go through his study report was a case in point where we have, I may get some of the particular details wrong, but the concept is right on, that we have some people doing desktop management in state government that have maybe 15 years experience and are making $80,000-$90,000 a year. The reality is, out in the private sector, with the automated tools and the fact that these things basically just kind of replicate themselves, and you don't really have an extremely complex task in front of you when you manage desktops, the average compensation is, you're probably dealing with a two-year person, maybe $40,000 or $50,000 a year. And so here's a case where, a specific example where, I'm sure those people are entirely quality people, but they're still doing a job that in some ways doesn't need to be done the same way. And in the private sector, from a productivity standpoint, they've found ways to capitalize on the new tools and techniques, and maybe we haven't in the public sector. So, again, the intention is to just part the clouds on all of that and make sure that what we're doing in the public sector passes muster for us as a legislature and with our taxpayers and, frankly, for the people themselves, too, so that everybody knows that this is a fair deal.
Well,
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, but I still don't understand why you wouldn't also consider then experience and education. I'm not saying you should only look at experience and education in comparing the workforces. If you know, you give an anecdotal example of one person in OET doing that particular skill and having a lot of experience. But if you look more broadly, I mean, the state of Minnesota generally has high outcomes compared to other states in areas like health, public health, cost of health care per capita, education achievement, all of these things. And yet we have one of the lowest rankings in public employees per capita of any state. Now, that's not a detailed look at outcomes, but in general, Minnesota is viewed as a pretty high-performing state in terms of public services and public benefits, and yet we have very low workforce per capita. It might just be that we've invested wisely in our workforce, and they're helping us get better results. But by you're really kind of putting the thumb on the scale and prescribing an outcome that you want, which is to lower the compensation level for public employees. And I might add that you're doing that and you're making a comparison to the private sector just as we're just barely turning the corner on one of the worst economic downturns in the century. And so what you're doing is locking public employee salaries and benefits to a comparison of the private sector at its bottom. And there isn't any provision in your bill for an ongoing comparison. So in 2 years, if the economy is roaring along, private sector wages are finally recovering, we've got low unemployment, and things are going great in the private sector, you don't have anything in this bill that would then link public sector employees back up to that. You're locking them in at the bottom. You're not accounting for their age or experience, and you're prescribing an outcome where they will have to take lower salaries and benefits without truly tying it to the private sector. And so if I was as cynical as Representative Goth here, I would suggest that this bill really is an attempt to undermine public employees rather than doing all the things that you talked about, because I just see this as completely a one-sided bill, assuming that public sector employees need to make less money without any real impact on the budget, without really achieving the outcomes that you were talking about. All this does is just interfere with public employees.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to assume that Representative Gauthier was cynical. Frankly, I thought we had a fairly principled exchange and in the end agreed that maybe we disagree less about the ends and more about the means, and I hope that's where we all feel we're at here on this committee. So you raised a number of points, Representative Winkler, and I'm trying to remember all of them. The core of it maybe being, shouldn't education and experience be the driver of compensation?
Included.
And I Boy, I don't know. I've never existed in an environment where you get paid because of a level of educational attainment and the number of years of experience. I've always existed in a place where you got a job to do, and we offer a salary and a compensation package for that job. And I think that's what we're trying to get at with this study, and it's exactly what the Taxpayers Association study did, at least in an introductory way. I don't know that I have an argument against including educational attainment and experience as a component, but many of the studies that have been produced, I think, are fundamentally flawed. They're important, perhaps, from an economic and a workforce analysis standpoint, but in terms of a compensation comparison, I think they totally break down. And I just happened to look at a couple over the last few months, one that just came out recently, and they very intentionally don't include the job that the person is performing. I mean, I just can't even imagine comparing compensation levels and not even looking at the work performed. On top of that, this particular study recognizes that there's a 35% kind of increase in very large organizations, of which state government would be one, and so they filter that out, and then they don't compare in the comparison to the private sector. They don't include people who are self-employed or people from the agricultural sector. And so, you know, people from the outside looking in, and we look at that workforce report, and over the last 4 years, the annual increases in total wages and compensation at the state were 7%, 4%, 2%, 1% on an annual basis. And the workforce has only really grown by about 200 or 300 people. And you compare that. Average person on the street compares that to what has happened up and down their block and out in the private sector, and there is a huge disconnect. A huge disconnect. People have lost 30-50% of their compensation over the last couple few years, and the assumption that state government would be the only entity in the entire state that is insulated from that, and that somehow we have to protect state government from that and not be kind of co-participants in what's going on. The Minsky system, local governments, they have all started this process. And state government is the only place that we haven't. And so we're trying to provide some mechanisms here that make it fair and make it obvious to everybody that it's fair. And then on top of that, provide some structural reforms so that our workers can be part of the process of changing and adapting to these new realities. I just can't imagine arguing against that as though somehow the status quo is the solution.
Mr. Chair, just a final point, because I don't think Representative Downey quite caught my point. What I said is that you're only interested in comparing to the private sector when the private sector is down. You're not interested in comparing to the private sector when the private sector is up. You're tying it, you know, this would be like tying all future compensation of public employees to public compensation in the midst of the Great Depression. You know, you're picking a point in time without having any ongoing study to make a comparison so that it ensures that public employees are permanently compared in wages and benefits to private employees when private employment has been at its worst in 60 years. You don't have any provision for a study to take place in 2 years and tie it to that. And I did not say that education and experience should be the only drivers for comparisons. I said that you didn't include them at all. So if you want to complain that some studies only look at experience in education, I would complain that your study only looks at the job function. It doesn't have any, make any accommodation for the other side of that equation. And I believe that as an employer, the state of Minnesota has consistently encouraged people to get better educated, better trained, to stick with the job for a long period of time, get experience. I think those are good things. And now your bill essentially wants to punish people for doing that by saying, now that you've made that investment and now that we've made that investment, we don't any longer want to tie your compensation to the investment that we've both made.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So a couple of things. Number one, this is a one-time reset, Representative Winkler, and beyond that, we haven't abrogated anything in the state complex. It basically says we've got a disconnect right now between what's happening in the public sector and everybody else's experience. So let's reset it, and then existing processes can perpetuate. So your assertion that somehow we're locking people into a Great Depression compensation level for the rest of their lives is certainly not intended. If you read my bill and somehow it does something different, we can work on language to address that. This is a one-time reset to make sure that everybody's feeling comfortable, both outside and inside state government, that we are fairly compensating our people. And I think educational attainment and experience are relevant to the extent that they have prepared you for the job function that you have. I just don't know any other place where you would look at educational attainment and experience as the driver. It's the work that you're performing and the value that you're adding. And I'll just leave it at that, and we may just agree to disagree. My critique of these other studies is that they specifically exclude the position, which is, in my mind, the defining attribute of where compensation should start.
Mr. Chair, just leave with an example, which is a nurse. It's not unreasonable that nurses actually have their compensation based on years of experience and level of educational attainment. In fact, that's kind of a big part of what we do. And we actually employ a lot of nurses. We're not just talking about bureaucrats sitting in an office typing in numbers.
We have four members on the list here, and then I'm going to turn to those who wish to speak from the audience and others who have requested an opportunity to be heard on this bill. We want to make sure we have time for those folks to be able to do that. Yesterday we got cut short on that. I don't want that to happen again. So next on the list is Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Downey, first, I think a little perspective is in order. As we've said in other committees and even in this committee, I think it's important to remember that employee compensation, including benefits, is only about 11% of state government. If you compare that to the complex of private industry, if you compare that to the percentage in the private sector that is usually taken up by people costs, it's much, much higher because, as you know, state government is basically a funnel. Resources go in and then they go out again on the basis of various formulas. So we give it to colleges and universities, we give it to hospitals and nursing homes, and all the rest. And so I don't know of too many private firms that can say that only 11% of their costs are people costs. So that's just something fundamental to state government. But if you look at the complex of the private sector, it's a very good comparison. I've handed out for the committee's benefit another study that came out last week, March 3rd, I think, by EPI. I can't say that I've looked at it in any great detail, but it provides at least another perspective. It asks the questions, are Minnesota public employees overcompensated? And the answer is no, that by a range of 7 to 11%, depending on how you measure, that they're not, that they're actually below the private sector. And, you know, I leave it to statisticians to talk about the methodology and all the rest. I can't say that I've looked at it in any detailed way, but I thought it was an interesting and refreshing perspective for the committee to look at, and it's very recent, having come out just last week. I wanted to ask you, you know, as you've said, you've tried to think big here in this bill. Could you describe to us the extent to which you've conferred with the executive branch about this bill? Has it been one meeting or four meetings or five meetings? To what extent have you conferred with folks in the Dayton administration who will have to administer all of this?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, I've had two or three meetings on a variety of different topics relative to government reforms. We have not gone deep into these particular provisions to fine-tune them with the administration. For me to represent that the administration supports these or has vetted these. In fact, I think you'll hear probably some testimony from the collective bargaining units that they do not support these provisions after having had a couple of brief conversations with them. And Mr. Chair, if I could take the liberty also, Representative Simon, you mentioned two preamble points to your question. And you know, you can talk about what percent of the workforce it is. I'm just looking at $2.3 billion worth of public spending, and if we can find a way to save 10 or 15% of that. The 15% workforce reduction bill actually translates into almost $700 million of savings per biennium. And while I appreciate to some folks maybe that's not a lot of money, I think to the average person, $700 million, $680 million, that's a lot of money. And so the purview of this committee is that budget. And so we're trying to do our part, and there are other committees that are going to have to do their part. But for us to shirk that because we're such a small slice of the pie, let's just remember this is an awfully huge pie. And even incremental savings on a subset of that pie is a pretty big chunk of money, and I think we would be irresponsible not to try and address it. And you mentioned the EPI report, and that actually is one that I read. And you mentioned that you hadn't gone into the details of it. I would encourage people to just read the foreword to that report. And it very specifically points out that they control only for experience, education, I think there's disability and other minority status kinds of factors, absolutely excludes the work being performed. Does not include the position the person holds. And I'm going to make an extreme example. It's probably not true in many cases, but 20 years with a master's degree, and if you're processing accounts payable checks, you know what? I'm sorry, the value being performed is of a person who's processing accounts payable checks, and frankly, your master's degree or your PhD isn't adding a lot of value to the public complex. So, and this report is the one that in the private sector comparison excludes all self-employed people, excludes everybody in agriculture. I'm not kidding. You guys go read the first four pages of this report in the private sector comparison. So every self-employed individual, every corner plumber, every market owner excluded in this compensation study. On top of that, they factor out the 35% increase that is generally experienced in large organizations. And there's a 35% value that they take out of the right off the top of the compensation being made by people in the private in the public sector. So, I mean, we can say this is the domain of economists, but I'm telling you, every time I hear that, I go read the preamble and look at the tables on these reports, because this is a fundamentally flawed report if you want to compare the compensation levels of people in the private sector versus the public sector. Pretty great information if you want to see what people can make in general if they have master's degrees and 20 years of experience, but not at all a good comparison for public versus private sector compensation.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think at bottom, though, I think we can agree that that 11% figure for the private, I mean, sort of the complex of private industry versus the public sector is, I don't think, refutable. So it's a pretty lean, if you want to do private-public comparisons, I think that's a fair one as well. We're not mostly people. In fact, we're hardly at all people. So you can cut 15% of the 11%, and I'm not saying that isn't a big number or a worthy number to chase. It is, but you got to do it the right way. I guess I would ask, too, and my first question was about your consultation with the Dayton administration or with the executive branch. I guess I'm assuming you don't yet have a partner. I think that's fair to say. What about with the collective bargaining units, the workers themselves? Can you describe to the committee your meetings with them? Have you had four or five meetings? Has it been one meeting? Have they been quick meetings? Have you had a give and take? Could you just describe your general efforts to reach out?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon, they have been very few and very short. I don't think you're going to find the collective bargaining units supporting my bill, and I think you'll probably hear them testifying against it today. And again, we just have a difference of opinion about the means to equip and empower our workforce, and I'm not wedded to the current structures, and they are, and so we have a difference of opinion. Again, I just think that the status quo isn't the solution.
Representative Simon?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if you could reconcile this bill with your 15% layoff bill, understanding that it is over the course of years and not immediate. Are those meant to be items on a menu that are mutually exclusive, or is your desired outcome that we do both? Would you like us to do both the 15% paring down of the workforce over a number of years and the pay freeze for the next year? Is that what you'd like to see, or are they kind of non-exclusive or mutually exclusive menu items.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, good question, great question. All of these are intended to be complementary. The workforce reduction, the reinventing of the public sector employment model. We've provided some concrete examples, for example, in the Office of Enterprise Technology, where we're actually providing some legislative inputs and design to how we get there. So all of this is intended to be hand in glove, working together.
Further?
Yes, thank you.
Representative Simon.
So, Mr. Chair, I mean, I think a fair-minded observer looking on all these hearings would say that this is probably more about saving money than it is about empowering workers. I can't get inside your head. I'm not questioning your motives, but I think a fair-minded objective observer would say that the powering impulse behind these bills is mostly, or the scale is tipped mostly, in favor of saving money rather than bringing out, making sure our workers are the best that they can be. You're right that all of us, I'm sure myself included, have, during the heat of a campaign or a floor debate or a committee debate, said things about this issue which we wish we could take back. You, in the Government Operations Committee, at one point, in response to a question on a different bill, but on the 15% bill, said that we ought to starve the beast. Do you want to take that back? Or do you still believe that? It's on tape. You think we should starve the beast? Or was that maybe impolitic?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon. Actually, I did not say that I wanted to starve the beast, and I can produce the transcript of the tape because I actually did go back and have that transcript created. If you remember the context of that discussion, I believe it was yourself and Representative Nelson in the Government Operations Committee suggested that setting a workforce reduction target was unwise, that we would be better off to cut appropriations and to get at the reduction in state government through the mechanism of specific appropriations. And my comment, and I'll do my best to try and recreate it exactly, I can produce the exact transcript for the committee here, was that whether it's public or private sector, if you're going after the back office and trying to find some ability to reduce costs, you've got two mechanisms. And one is you do it by cutting appropriations, to use a crude term, starve the beast, which is a figure of speech, or you do it through setting a hard target like the workforce reduction that I was proposing. And so, frankly, I did not suggest that I wanted to starve the beast or that my methodology was to do it by just cutting appropriations. In fact, the proposal that we were discussing was one that was very strategic, intentional, and planful. And in fact, the suggestions of yourself and other folks were more getting towards cutting appropriations, which is that methodology, not the one I was proposing.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment about the provision that you've collaborated with on with Representative Stensrud, the 5% holdback. I've seen in the clients that I represent in my law firm, I've seen people maybe reduce, I've seen corporations reduce a base for a number of years and then have a separate bonus pool. But I confess that I've never seen someone say that we're taking 5% of the actual base, not shrinking the base, but saying you only get 95% of your base. Can you think of other private sector employees who have taken away 5% of the base and then said you can earn back the base if you're good? Have you encountered that in the private sector?
Representative,
I haven't.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think you accurately described what's proposed in the bill. I think what we're saying is that for any individual, in looking at their total compensation, that 5% of it should be discretionary based on performance of themselves, their unit, and their overall agency. And I mean, I would say every company I've ever been a part of had some kind of a bonus structure like that. And when you look at your overall compensation, a component of it, and as you get more senior and have kind of more at stake, it becomes an increasing component, but some component of it is always quote-unquote at risk and performance-based. I just think that's the way we align people's objectives and incentives to be the same as the organization and the rest of their coworkers.
Finished? Representative Simon?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Downey, for moving this legislation forward. Just a couple of comments. I know Representative Winkler, when I listened to a couple of his comments, I found myself thinking I almost agree with him in some of the phrasing. We talked about education, and it kind of concerned me for a minute until I really thought it through. But I think it's important to stipulate we don't get educated and further get degreed just to increase our compensation. It's maybe sort of semantics in how you word it. We get educated to get better skills and to get more marketable and have better core competencies so that we can produce an outcome and be of greater value to the organizations for which we get hired. It shouldn't work the other way. You sort of think, hey, that person got a new degree, they got a master's, and they got a great big bump in pay. Well, in most organizations, when you get better at what you do, sometimes that comes with a degree. You get a degree, you get better education, and you get better core competencies, and you have greater value to the organization. But it's not just because you have degrees. So I just wanted to clarify that. And if we're on the same page with that, we got one thing we agree on here today, Representative Winkler. And then to Representative Benson's points earlier, you know, I once had a great manager who said that you always have to expect or don't expect what you don't inspect. You know, it's kind of nice little phrasing, but it's very important. And you have to have objectives. And you can't actually ask for something that you don't give incentives for. I mean, a boss can come along and say, oh, by the way, you got to take out the garbage. And you're thinking, yeah, that's not in my job description. How come you don't make the other guy do the garbage can? I know it's not my job. But if you specifically put into a compensation plan goals and objectives and measure towards those and inspect those, you're going to get everybody on the same page. And surprise, it works for the little person working for the management. It also works for the management. It works both ways. A manager is going to be graded on how well do the people perform. That could be a great percentage of their compensation. And that's going to work in this plan, too, if it's designed properly. I can't imagine a scenario where a commissioner would design a compensation for a manager that doesn't say you're going to get paid for the outcome your people do. And if they don't perform, the manager's not going to. So it works both ways, and it's done all across America. Thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, I prior to coming up here to the Capitol, I was on the city council, and I remember when I first got on the city council, I was perhaps a little more like you than you would realize. I kind of thought I'd go there and I'd find a lot of waste, a lot of people sitting around doing nothing. And you know what I found out is that a lot of people show up, show a lot of pride in their work, and do a good job for the taxpayers. And you know, I grew up in small business, and now I work for one of the biggest companies in the state of Minnesota. Well, Atlanta now. But we have some good employees there and we have some bad, and I found the same thing in my government experience. And but overall, I've been really impressed with people that show up and do good jobs and take it serious. And I guess philosophically, you know, you talk about all that, and you know, for me, I just have a pure different philosophy. I mean, you hire good people and you compensate them. And if they're, you pay them well, expect a lot, and then you get rid of them, you know, if they don't do the job. So that's, you know, philosophically kind of what I bring to the table. Over the weekend, I was watching TV, and they had this little personal story, and I thought it was pretty neat. It was about this swim coach, and 50-some years in Edina. And this guy had these cool glasses like Phyllis Kahn's a little bit. And, you know, he'd been there a long time. I don't know if he... I really didn't know that it was your father. I kind of noodled around. And I was, you know, the name, and then I checked it, and I looked at your website, you know, for like your campaign, because I really didn't know it was your dad. And there's this cool picture with you, and then in your thing it says that, you know, just how much you value teachers, and you know that that they're vital to your community, and you know your core beliefs. And you know, I guess I'm a little shocked that you of all people growing up in that environment and that you don't have a different value for the public workers. So I guess I just, you know, and I don't know how you address that, and I'm just really surprised, I guess, you know, because I got out of that piece on your father is that he showed pride, showed up, did good work, and is an asset to the community. And I would imagine you've seen that every day and lived it, and that'd be a tough act to follow, of course, having a dad that's so amazing. I'm just curious. I guess a question: I would like to know who you'd like to cut. You know, I mean, or you know, you talk about pay. Or who are you going to cut? Are you going to cut the jailer, you know, that's watching the sex offender? Or are you gonna cut those nurses that he talked about so they're working shorter? I don't know if you've ever done that work. It's kind of physical. A lot of people get hurt. Are you going to work them shorter? How about today? We got snow out there. Are you going to cut the snow plower? How about the highway patrol that's already all by himself and covering counties all over our state? I guess, who are you going to cut? I mean, I know that's, you know, and then you, I guess I challenge you to have a little courage. Why don't you take on these teachers? You know, why don't you go after them and cut, you know, I mean, like the Dean Erdahls of the world, who are out doing a good work, you know, reach your hand into that hornet's nest, and you know, don't pick on, you know, like us legislators. You know, you're cutting legislative folks. Yeah, we're gonna cut, you know, because we've got a raise. Which, you know, are you gonna just have in the legislature rich people? I don't know if you know. You probably don't know much about me, but you know, I'm not a wealthy person. So on Saturday and Sunday, you guys might be home doing constituent service. I wish I could be, but like in the afternoons, I'm at the airport working, you know, both those days. So, you know, do you want just wealthy people here in the legislature or retired folks that can offer their time? I think the intent was to have a, you know, legislature that is compensated, that people can give the time, and that you can't just, you know, you don't have just one group of people. But I guess I'll just stop for a second and ask you the question. Who do you want to cut, Representative Downey? Who are those folks? Put a face on it.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Lilly. I will answer your question, but before I do, we had a similar exchange with Representative Gauthier, maybe before you got here, I don't know. But I tell you what, I think people need to be careful. When they start impugning other people's motives or their backgrounds. My dad was a teacher for 35 years. My mom waitressed at a restaurant. My grandfather worked for the Minnesota Highway Department. My great-grandfather died of black lung working in a mine in Montana. My wife's dad was a forester for the DNR in Wisconsin. My wife's mother worked in preschool in Wisconsin. My wife's mom did not have running water in her farm until she was 16 years old. And so, to infer through your comments that the people that are trying to advance structural reform and ways to empower our workers are somehow the enemy of those workers, be careful. I have an innate trust and an innate belief, and I think everybody around this table does, in the people that work in state government. And if you think that the status quo of the structures that they work in is the formula for success in the future, then you and I disagree. And this has absolutely nothing to do about the people. It has everything to do with the structures that we have locked them into that is a barrier to the progress that we need to make. And I'll defend these proposals as being good for teachers and good for workers and good for taxpayers, because it takes away the barriers that exist right now for those people to do the job and to accomplish this big challenge that we have. This is not about simply perpetuating the processes of the status quo. We have significant change that we need to bring about in the public sector. And you're not going to get there without people and processes and technology all changing and going in the same direction at the same time. So to infer from your comments that somehow these proposals and others like them or the people advancing them don't care about those people, I absolutely reject that. I think it's because we do care and because we do believe in them. We believe in the people, not the processes and the structures that we've locked them into for the last 30 years, but the people. And this is about giving them the tools to participate in this and breaking down this kind of labor versus management dichotomy that's been created through all this. So I would argue in the exact reverse. I think the people, the folks that are bringing these proposals forward are the ones that believe in these people. You mentioned the legislature. I've specifically excluded the legislature from this bill. I think we have a big enough challenge trying to right-size and reshape the state government executive branch complex, so we've focused exclusively on that. And to your point about who are you going to cut, first of all, that's a different bill, but again, just to remind people, that bill set a workforce reduction target to be accomplished hopefully exclusively, if not almost entirely, through existing attrition, and then if necessary through an early retirement program. So we're not cutting anybody, and we are relying on the integrity and strategy of the governor to find out exactly where to do that. So if you're concerned about cutting snowplow drivers and nurses, that's a conversation for the governor, not for me. We're setting the target and saying we know we can get there. We've seen plenty of evidence in the OET study and other studies that tell us we can get there. So I trust the governor to get there in a way that's best for the state and best for our people.
Mr. Representative Lilly, and then we're going to need to move on in order to give people an opportunity to address us. Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, and I just asked the author to take a look at your line 118 of the bill, and it does say legislative still. Representative Downey, I guess I'm kind of glad you're a little mad. I'm livid. It is about people, and I don't understand. I still don't understand. You like to twist it, and it's pretty clever. You're a better talker than I am, and I buy that, and accept it. But I'm not against reform. I haven't been. I won't be. I'm for it. But at the end of the day, it's people we're talking about. And again, like I said earlier in my statements, it's hire good people, give them a job to do, and get rid of them if they're not good people. So, I like your stories, and I it's sadly true that I don't know all your facts about all your history. But sometimes you need to remember where you came from. And I guess, and if that makes you mad, I really don't care. You need to know who you are. We had a governor of the state of Minnesota that grew up in South St. Paul, went to public school, went to the public university, and then forgot where he came from. And I challenge you, Representative Downey, to be the same. Remember where you came from. And I think it'll make you a better person. So if that's impugning your personal space or whatever you want to call it, I don't have all the legal, that's not my skill set. And if it makes you mad, I'm sorry. You got me pretty mad there, sir.
Representative Downey, or can we move to testifiers? Can you make it very
clear? One line.
Okay.
And it was just to Representative Bennion. I think the example he specifically gave is that without these kind of constraints in legislation, the unions and the employers, as they did in Minsky, are capable of negotiating the kind of things we want to, put in on top of them by law. And so I think all you need to do is remember that and dump this bill and let it take place in the collective bargaining arena where it's more appropriate.
Okay, we're going to move to those who have requested an opportunity to speak. Representative Mape. And we're going to need to, we've got a whole stack of amendments here, so we're going to need to move to those within the next 15 minutes. So,
please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Richard Kujewski from MAPE. MAPE proposes House File 192. The first section that we take exception to is the salary freeze that's been discussed here this morning. State government hires employees. They enter into a term and condition of employment for a salary. As I testified yesterday in the policy committee, our members, the state government in statute is required to adhere to some sort of study to determine the fair market value for every position in state government, every job title. Those positions are, the system that they use is called the Hay Study. That Hay Study determines their fair market value based on a point scale. They take into account private sector jobs that are comparable, that Representative Downey is concerned is not in the EPI study, and they award them a salary based on that study alone. We did a bill about 3 years ago that showed from MMB's numbers that 70% of our employees are not compensated appropriately based on the state's own study. The statute requires them to conduct the study and does not require them to pay them based on that study that they do. That really does confirm the results of the EPI study that says 7.9% or state employees are undercompensated by 7.9%. Future compensation, Representative Downey wants to conduct a study that state government has already done and completed on every position title in the state of Minnesota. On the contracting piece, Representative Downey, again in this bill, allows commissioners, one person in the state of Minnesota, to determine whether or not they should outsource for any job or service in the state of Minnesota. We have people, professionals, who do that work over in the Department of Administration, and I haven't been around here as long as many of you, but I've yet to hear a complaint about the work and the quality of work and the ethical work that those people do. And by allowing one person to make those decisions, you're removing the ethical practices and conflict of interest that go along with contracting out in the state of Minnesota. The last piece I'm just going to touch on is the performance appraisal and bonus pay. This provision in the bill evaluates employees based on their individual performance, yet their individual performance is defined in the bill as the overall agency's performance. And to withhold 5% of their pay until such a time is set to evaluate the quality of work that they do is equivalent to this scenario. Imagine withholding all of your staff's pay 5%. I've heard many speeches on the House floor and in committee thanking staff for staying up the long hours getting everyone through to the end of session. So imagine last year, had this provision been in law, when session adjourns, but there's a deal, but time runs out. It didn't quite get the job done with enough time to go through the documentation, so you had to call a special session. Well, you might not have met your goals then. Therefore, we hold 5% of their salaries. And that's essentially what this bill does. Representative Downey talks about big projects. Not every state employee works on special projects. They're hired to do a job, and they work hard at it. Employees get paid for the work that they do every 2 weeks. This bill doesn't require management to hold these people accountable every 2 weeks. It doesn't require them to coach these employees if they're not doing their job. It doesn't require them to discipline these employees. It just waits until the time is such that, well, maybe we won't give you this 5% or more, because the bill doesn't restrict it to just 5%. Now, Representative Banyan talked about what's commonly known in state government as achievement awards. Achievement awards at MNSCU may still happen. I'm not so certain, but I can tell you for all of state government beyond that, they've been froze for many years. 5, 6, 7 years, at least to my knowledge. So Representative Downey talks about there being plenty of demagoguery out there. And I, for one, I believe I'm the only labor rep who's met with Representative Downey. And I thought we did have a good meeting. And we certainly are not going to agree on this bill. We didn't discuss this bill, actually. But I will tell you, this bill was the right-to-work bill. This bill was anti-labor from the beginning. And I do challenge the motivation to put an anti-work constitutional amendment in a bill, whether it's in or out today, is an anti-labor bill. Members, I'll stand for any questions if you have.
Please limit the questions so we can get to the other testifiers. Representative Gauthier.
Very briefly. Representative Downey talked about structures that we have locked them into. When MAPE negotiates a contract, somebody from administration signs it, and somebody from the union, correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, our entire negotiation.
So the agreement is between the employer and the employees, these are the rules of which we operate, correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gauthier, correct.
And it's a mutual agreement. So we haven't locked you into anything arbitrarily.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gauthier.
Mr. Golodetsky.
Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is
Representative
correct.
Representative Gauthier, okay. please come through.
Just one more question, Chair. Has anybody from administration approached you and say, it's not working, can we renegotiate this aspect of the agreement?
Mr. Golodetsky?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no one from administration has approached us on renegotiating the collective bargaining agreement with the current salary structure and performance appraisal language in it. I would suggest that I'm probably speaking on behalf of all labor here today, and none of us have discussed this bill in specifics with Representative Downey either.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, this is Kolesky. Is there anything that would prevent MAPE, say, in its next contract negotiations to talk about pay for performance?
Mr. Kolesky.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, no.
Thank you for being here. Next, we have a representative of Teamsters Local 2320. Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Robert Johnson. I represent 11,000 Teamster members that are public employees in the state. And clearly the bill, the reinvent of government employment, does impact not all of my members, but a great deal of them. We represent law enforcement, we represent jailers, we represent public defenders, we represent court reporters, all of which have that same aspect to it, that they're public employees. This bill does call for a 5% wage reduction. There's no question about it, and I appreciated some of the comments that were made earlier regarding that issue. When you remove 5% and then dedicate it to a bonus, I just don't see how it's happening. But I do want to just confine my remarks to PELRA. PELRA has been the flagship in this state for public employee negotiations. It was first enacted in 1971. There's been a few amendments to it, but by and large, it has worked and worked extremely well in terms of the negotiating process of collective bargaining. We have not seen wholesale strikes around the state. We've not seen a lot of labor disputes. In fact, we've seen a lot of harmony and cooperation as it applies to collective bargaining as a result of PELRA. This bill, on its second page, clearly says that this section supersedes Chapter 179A, and that's PELRA. And so it's, again, another erosion into what public employees and employers have had to work with over these 30 years or so. With that, I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, I'm reading again from the bill from just looking at salary for upcoming biennium, looking at Article 5. I don't see the word remove in here. So let me ask you the question this way. If in negotiations 5% additional money was put in and tied to performance, that would be acceptable under this bill and would not be, no money would have been removed, correct?
Mr. Johnson?
If I understand your question, I believe so.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Next, representative of IFO, Mr. Stanton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name for the record is Russ Stanton from the Interfaculty Organization. Testify essentially with regard to an amendment that I see as pending, the A9 amendment, and that is to remove the Minsky faculty from the performance pay section of the bill. My testimony is essentially the same as what it was yesterday in GovOp, and that is that for faculty, we essentially have a form of performance pay. It's called tenure and promotion. People do not get tenure by seat time at state universities. They go through a five-year probationary period. They're evaluated by their peers. They're evaluated by their supervisors, and frankly, some of them don't make it. Also, the promotions from instructor to assistant to associate to full professor are done through peer review and through supervisory review. They do develop a professional development plan that addresses five criteria that are negotiated in the contract. And quite frankly, that is a type of performance pay. And by the way, pay is attached to promotions from assistant to associate to full professor. It's about a 4.85% pay increase that people get when they're promoted. And that's a type of performance pay that, quite frankly, is widely accepted by the employees, by the faculty. It's accepted by the universities. It's deeply embedded. The rank system is deeply embedded in academic culture. And frankly, if we were to bring in an outside type of performance pay, it would make our institutions less attractive in terms of attracting and retaining faculty. And the other point I would make is that we are different in that we do have an outside board of trustees that's charged with managing the system, including negotiating the contracts, et cetera. And, you know, they're not a bunch of labor goons. I mean, it's these are all former Governor Pawlenty's appointees. They include people such as the executive director of the Taxpayers League, the executive director, a former trustee was executive director of the Chamber of Commerce, another was former executive director of the Business Partnership. You know, we negotiate with these people. We negotiate hard. We wouldn't be earning our dues if we didn't negotiate hard. But in the end, we've always been able to have reach agreements, and we've never had a strike. And frankly, we would appreciate not being micromanaged and that we be able to develop performance incentives that are appropriate for our situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stanton. Representative Banyan?
Thank you. Mr. Stanton, I'm looking first at lines 2.31 through 2.33, which removes Minsky from the provisions of that section.
Yes.
Is it your understanding, and this question might be for Representative Downey too, is it your understanding that Article 5 would apply to Minsky?
Yes.
Mr. Stanton?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bannon, yes, it is my impression. And yesterday I raised that issue, and I think this amendment is in response to what I...
We'll wait to see if Mr. Representative Downey wants to speak to it, but thank sure. you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stanton. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard? Again, we are not we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Yes, Ms. Blair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Julie Blau, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5, and I'm not going to repeat the material that the labor reps before me presented, but to say that we agree with their comments. There is one thing I'd like to point out. with regard to the state of Wisconsin and what public employees are facing that was launched by Governor Scott Walker, this is no different. This is collective bargaining. This is a process that should take place between the employees and the administration as appointed by the governor. PELRA has worked well in the past, and essentially what this does is infringe upon the rights, and it takes away the collective bargaining from the employees. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing that no one else wishes to be heard, there are a number of amendments that are in your packet. We have amendments that any member is wishing to make. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll claim the A6 amendment. A6. If I may, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be brief. This is essentially a pay-to-play amendment along the lines of what states like New Jersey and I believe others have done recently, which is to say that if we're going to open up in a substantial way the ability of private firms to bid for state businesses, this bill, I believe, would do that. We ought to have some safeguards in there to make sure that we don't have the appearance of impropriety. This would just say that a state agency can enter into a contract with a vendor if the vendor itself has contributed to an entity that made an independent expenditure in a state election in the last 2 years. Now, it doesn't include federal elections, but in state elections that would bear on the legislature, the governor, and so forth. That's the amendment. I ask for your support, and I'd ask for a roll call.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, I would oppose the amendment. Is it possible for the author to offer an oral amendment to an amendment to his bill, sure, if I'm a member of the committee?
For you to author an amendment to his bill, I think so, Mr. Shepard?
To his amendment.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'd offer the following oral amendment on line 1.5 or 1.4 after the word vendor, insert or collective bargaining unit. And on line 1.5, similarly, after the word vendor, insert or collective bargaining unit.
Everyone clear on that amendment to the amendment? Mr. Shepard, do you have that? Representative Simon, is that the friendly amendment?
Well, I would say this. I think we should have the discussion about how this is probably apples and oranges, but I want to understand a little bit more about Representative Downey's amendment to the amendment. I assume that within the construction of this amendment, your intention at least is to, as I assume the language must, say that it only applies to new contracts, not a collecting of bargaining agreement itself, but any outside kind of outsourcing. You gave the example of San Diego, for example. So if we were to sort of outsource this, a collective bargaining unit couldn't bid for the business if that unit had made an independent expenditure, right? Is that what you're saying?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, correct. And I know 16C only applies to outsourced contracts, right, but if the intent of your amendment is to kind of highlight outside business parties making independent expenditures, I think it's fair to add the collective bargaining units who are highly engaged politically already.
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, I consider that a friendly amendment.
Okay, do you want to incorporate that into your...
Sure.
Representative Simon incorporates that oral amendment into his A6 amendment. Representative Downey, then you support this amendment
As amended. Yes.
As amended. Do you still? The roll call has been requested. Unless you want to withdraw your roll call.
Mr. Chair, no. We might as well go on the record.
Okay. You read the roll call.
Anderson.
Yes.
Bannion.
Yes.
Benson.
Yes.
Downey.
Yes.
Gauthier.
No.
Green.
No.
Gunther.
Yes.
Hayden.
No.
Kahn.
No.
Lanning.
Yes.
Leidiger?
Yes.
Lilly?
No.
Lohmer?
Yes.
McElfatrick?
Yes.
Murphy?
No.
Murray?
Yes.
Simon?
Yes.
Slawik?
No.
Stensrud?
Yes.
Erdahl?
Yes.
Winkler?
No.
There being 13 yeses and 8 noes, the amendment is adopted. A6 amendment is adopted as amended. Next amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden.
I will grab the A8 amendment, and I'd like to request a roll call.
Hayden, you want to speak to your amendment?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. The A8 amendment is pretty straightforward. Representative Downey and his bill in Article 4 talked about value-added services, and it goes on to talk about there may be some opportunities to hire outside vendors to do some of the work. And this is just basic disclosure. It's what we have for our nonprofits, that if we do go out and seek a private vendor, that they would report total compensation paid for the five highest paid directors, officers, and employees of the business that receive a compensation more than $50,000. So it's just simply disclosure. If we're going to do work with outside vendors, we'd like to see what their highest ranking officers make.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, I'd support this amendment as well. And actually, this comes from a conversation that we had with Representative Nelson in Government Operations Committee. I think he was suggesting that maybe there might be some kind of points or scoring in the award of contracts based on the higher level pay. So actually, I think this is a slightly more moderated version of that suggestion. So I'd accept it. I think this is a good idea. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden, do you still wish to go through with a roll call, given the fact he's accepted it?
Looks like Representative.
Thank you. Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to wonder if the author would accept a friendly amendment to also include peace officers.
Representative Hayden.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see the problem. Can you explain why you want to do that?
Well, we mentioned other law enforcement deals, but police officers are not included in that, and I'd like to include them in state patrol.
We're on a different amendment.
No, we're on A8. Mr. Chair, we're on A8. Representative.
Okay, excuse me.
Okay. Never mind. I'd still like to roll call, Mr. Chair. I think it's
okay,
important.
Your request.
Thank you, sir.
So call the roll on A8.
Anderson.
Yes.
Banyan.
Yes.
Benson. Downey?
Yes.
Gauthier?
Yes.
Green?
Yes.
Gunther?
Yes.
Which amendment?
A8.
Hayden?
Yes.
Kahn?
Yes.
Lanning?
Yes.
Leidiger?
No. We'll get him for that.
Lilly?
Yes.
Lohmer?
Yes.
McElfatrick?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Murray?
Yes.
Simon?
Yes.
Slawik?
Yes.
Stensrud?
Yes.
Erdahl?
Yes.
Winkler?
Yes.
There being 20 yes and 1 no, the amendment A8 is adopted. Next amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the adoption of the A10 amendment.
You want to speak to your amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, we've just gone through a pretty extensive discussion at the state level about the need for speeding up our permitting process, and the legislative auditor's report coming out talks about the need for better training, better education, better knowledge, better awareness of how to conduct the environmental permitting process. I'm concerned that a compensation freeze, as it applies to employees in those agencies, would be harmful to that effort, and so I think that we should exempt that permitting staff from this compensation freeze to make sure that we move forward on those important initiatives.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't support this amendment. I think the compensation freeze is designed to apply to all executive branch agencies, and there are some other amendments that might have some more meritorious exceptions that we could discuss, but I wouldn't support the A-10.
Mr. Chair, in that case, I request a roll call.
Okay. Roll call has been requested, and you call a roll on the A-10 amendment.
Anderson.
No.
Banyan.
No.
Benson.
No.
Downey.
No.
Gauthier.
Yes.
Green.
Yes.
Gunther.
No.
Hayden.
Yes.
Kahn.
Yes.
Lanning.
No.
Leidiger.
No.
Lilly.
Yes.
Lohmer.
No.
McElfatrick.
No.
Murphy.
Yes.
Murray.
No.
Simon.
Yes.
Slawik.
Yes.
Stensrud.
No.
Erdahl.
No.
Winkler.
Yes.
There being 12 no's and 9 yeses, the amendment is not adopted. Next Chair. Amendment. Representative Gauthier.
A-11, please. This would exempt snowplow drivers and state troopers. I think we can agree that these are vital employees work beyond regular hours and to response to emergencies. And without our snowplow drivers, we'd close the state down. And to Representative Gunther's about police officers, I don't know that the state hires any peace officers other than state troopers. I may be wrong, and if you could clarify that for me.
Representative Gunther.
We have capital security and groups like that. I think they should be included.
I would. An airport. I would find that as friendly.
Thank you.
And I would ask for a roll call.
So, Representative Gauthier, are you amending your...
Yes, to include peace officers.
And would you indicate where that should be then? And
say snowplow drivers or state troopers or peace officers.
Okay. Mr. Shepard, you have that. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a question for Representative Gunther or Representative Gauthier, whoever wishes to answer. Would that apply just to police officers then hired by the state, not our local police officers?
Yes.
Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Mr. Chairman, can I?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess just a couple of points. So the intended exclusive focus of this bill is executive branch agency personnel. And so I just want to be clear that local units of government and local officials and local police and public safety folks are not the subject of this bill. So I guess don't infer from the bill or this amendment that that's the case. Secondly, I just want to point out, can I offer an oral amendment again, Mr. Chair?
You may.
To the amendment as amended by Representative Gunther, I would like to strike snowplow drivers. So that would be state troopers and the individuals that Representative Gunther mentioned.
Representative Gauthier, is that a friendly or unfriendly amendment?
Unfriendly.
Okay. So you're moving to strike snowplow drivers?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to speak to that?
I'd offer that as an oral amendment.
You want to speak to that?
Well, I think there's some merit in the police officers and other folks have come to me and talked about this provision, and I think I'm willing to grant the exemption from the wage freeze and allow them to have, you know, whatever they are negotiating or have as part of their package. I would mention to members also that this would not exempt them from the wage study and then resetting the wages. So this is really just a kind of a one-year exemption, and I guess I'm willing to grant that for the police officers and or the state troopers. I don't know that snowplow drivers fit into that category in my estimation, so I'd propose excluding snowplow drivers and offer that as an oral amendment.
Okay, Representative Downey has moved to amend the amendment by deleting snowplow drivers.
A roll call on that.
The roll call has been requested. you're clear on the, this is an amendment to the amendment that you have before you. It would delete the word snowplow drivers. Call the roll.
Anderson.
Yes.
Bannion.
Yes.
Benson.
Yes.
Downey.
Yes.
Gauthier.
No.
Green.
No.
Gunther.
Yes.
Hayden.
No.
Kahn.
No.
Lanning.
Yes.
Leidiger.
Yes.
Lilly.
No.
Lohmer.
Yes.
McElfetrick.
Yes.
Murphy.
No.
Murray.
Yes.
Simon.
No.
Slawick.
No.
Stensrud.
Yes.
Erdahl.
Yes.
Winkler.
No.
Motion has 12 yeses and 9 noes, so the amendment, oral amendment, is adopted. We now have before us the
Mr. Chair.
Amendment as amended. Yes, Representative Lilly.
I'd like to offer an amendment, please.
Okay.
To the amendment, or for correction officers. Corrections officers.
To insert correction officer?
That's correct, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Want to speak to that?
I would consider that friendly.
Okay. Representative Gauthier has accepted that. Mr. Shepard, do you have that?
Yes.
So the amendment now before you. Mr. Shepard, would you read the amendment now as it now stands, as it's been changed?
Mr. Chair, members, the amendment with the incorporation of corrections officers would read, the compensation freeze in this subdivision does not apply to persons employed as state troopers, comma, peace officers, comma, or corrections officers.
Mr. Chair,
I withdraw
my request for a roll call.
No roll call. All in favor, Representative Downey, you wish to speak to the amendment as it's been amended?
Mr. Chair, members vote their conscience.
Representative Leidiger.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to recommend that we vote no on any of these. I'm looking at some of these other amendments. The next one's going to be, you know, to exclude the veteran service providers or public health nurses. Then the next one after that is the tax compliant auditors. This one has, I guess it's now state troopers and peace officers, and now we want, you know, we're going to talk about correction officers. We're only talking about a one-year freeze here, and I don't think anybody should be exempt. So I'm recommending that we don't approve any of these exemptions. So this particular vote that I think we're about to take, I'm going to recommend we vote no on it.
The roll call.
And I would like a roll call.
Roll call has been requested on the amendment as amended.
But I'd like everybody to vote no.
We'll see where that goes. Call the roll, please. This is the A11 amendment as amended.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'd like to withdraw my amendment.
The amendment has been withdrawn. Members, we're already overtime here. And there will be plenty of opportunity to further discuss this as we consider our omnibus bill. And so I'm going to have to adjourn our meeting, and we will have opportunities to discuss this much further along the way. Members, please remember tomorrow it's at 8:30. 8:30 tomorrow, because tax Ways and Means needs to be in here first. So, meeting adjourned.
I should have made it more clear.